Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 205, featuring our very own Phil Miller, who is the Vice President of Product Management at Chaos Group and is a really fascinating person. He has been around the industry for a long time and is so important to the development of all the products that have come out in CG and 3D specifically. I cannot tell you how cool it was to sit down with him. This was actually Vlado suggesting. He says, oh, you guys are both in Bulgaria. We actually recorded this back at the end of October when we were both in Sofia going over some product planning for 2019. And so Phil and I sat down. And I've always known Phil as, you know, a very bright guy who's been in the industry for a while, but I had no idea how far back his influence reaches. I mean, he was back in the days of 3D Studio, not 3DS Max, but 3D Studio in DOS, and part of that group that was developing that. And he was really instrumental to all of 3D Studio's development, including 3DS Max. He was also part of Adobe for a while. He was part of Mental Images. He was at Autodesk for a long time. And also at NVIDIA, which is the last place he was before he joined us over here at Chaos Group. And when he was at NVIDIA, he was a big part of the rendering process. He was one of the main people behind Iray. So it was really, really fascinating to hear his take on, you know, everything going on, GPU rendering, the future, all of that stuff. So he's really, really a great guy, and it was a pleasure to sit down with him. And I'm sure you guys will have lots of questions for him. So make sure that after you listen to the podcast, don't be afraid to put some comments in our comment section. Ask, you know, Phil more questions. Maybe we'll have an Ask Phil podcast as a follow-up on this. I'm sure he'd love to answer some of those amazing questions. So really, really great. I don't really have any real announcements right now. This podcast is going to go out, I think, on New Year's Eve. And that will be kind of exciting. So for those of you who are listening to this, I'm sure it'll be after New Year's. So I wish you all a happy new year. I'm sure 2019 will be exciting for you guys. I am very much looking forward to 2019. There's a lot of stuff that's going to be announced. And I'm very excited about all of those things going on in 2019. And that's about it, guys. Hopefully you guys will enjoy this fabulous podcast with Phil Miller.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Long before you even started at Chaos Group, when the first time I met you was actually when you were at NVIDIA, right? Mm-hmm. And the person who introduced me to you was John Eisen.
Yeah.
And John introduced me to you because John and I had been working on a bunch of, you know, stuff with Kevin Margot and Construct and stuff like that.
Yeah, sounds great.
And which was cool. But he said, oh, you're going to really like Phil. He's an architect. Right?
Yeah.
And then I thought about it, like, you know, you... So there are three people who came to this very coincidentally, who came to meet in Chaos Group to deal with all these meetings. That's you, Lon, and I.
Yeah.
And people know who Lon is based on a podcast. But what's really funny is that the three of us both have an architecture degree.
Mm-hmm. We do.
And so that is a very interesting thing. So I want to start with the architecture part of your background.
Okay.
And how that was something that started your interest in visuals, I guess, in mm-hmm. some way. So what got you into architecture?
Well, I loved drawing. I loved designing. So I was drawn to architecture from the very beginning.
Right.
So... that was a natural. And at the time, CG actually wasn't even a term because it was like so science fiction back in the 80s. But, you know, CAD was, and it was barely there. Right. And the what drew, actually drew me into it was being able to set up my 3D models just to be able to get my perspectives right.
Right.
Because what I would do is
constructing a perspective was a manual process that was very tedious.
Right? Oh, yeah. And if you got your eye position wrong or your horizon line wrong, you'd have to do it all over again.
Right.
And so what I would do is I would set up all my massing models, so to speak, and then trace over them.
Right.
And that's how I started to get into it, because the 3D software at the time was very, very primitive. And then, but over time, I started doing more and more and more in 3D. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, that became the drawing. But until then, I was just using it as an underlay for doing hand sketches.
Right. And what were you using back then?
That back then was AutoCAD.
AutoCAD.
Yeah.
So what year are we talking about approximately?
Oh, we're talking about like 1988. So we're talking about AutoCAD 10.
Right. Okay. And that was an architecture school.
Architecture school was even before then, because we were actually at AutoCAD something like 2.6, 2.7. It did a big version jump from like 2.x to 9.
Yes.
So and then it went to 10. And 10 was actually... The joke with an Autodesk was always that you needed an even release. That was a good one.
Right. And I do remember learning, the first time I learned AutoCAD, I think, was version 12.
It was an even release, right? It was good.
And so, which was a good one. And I believe that was 93? Does that sound about right?
Yeah, it sounds about right. Yeah, because it was 13 that came about later that nearly sank the company. But, yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you were out of architecture school by the time you picked up 3D.
Yeah, because 3D didn't really become real until I just got out. And before that, I was actually, ironically, I was anti-computer because I thought it was like taking away the creative capability.
Uh-huh.
But then I saw it as an aid rather than, you know, I didn't see it as an end to itself. And then I saw it as an aid and it really helped me. And then I just got more and more into it.
Right.
And over time, the software got better and better. And it did become an end in itself.
Right. But what is it about first you saw, and I agree, like first you said like, oh, this is going to make my perspective drawing a lot easier, right? Mm-hmm. Because that was a thing, right? And this was during the time when doing a hidden line drawing could take like hours and hours and hours to do.
Well, plus it looked like junk.
Right.
Because, I mean, remember, this was the time when if a plane intersected another plane, you got nothing.
Right.
Right. So you would have to go in and add that intersection line.
Right.
So it was really, you know, it was only good for overlays.
It was only good for overlays. Right, yeah. Exactly. And how would you print them at that time? Was it a plot printer?
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh yeah, you have the pens and print it out, e-size sheets. Yeah.
Do you remember there was someone who figured out that if you put a pen in a plot printer that didn't quite fit right and it would jiggle?
Oh yeah, it was even better than that. So what you'd do is you would take an X-Acto blade and you would actually scribe out the little holder, and then to get it to be really sketchy, you'd go and get a Mexican hat from one of the drinks from the Mexican bar.
Okay, all right, yeah.
And it would actually get the wobble, and you could actually put like a little piece of clay or something on the edge of the hat to get the
extra weight.
Yeah, exactly. To like how much like sketchy it was. But yeah,
basically you would use a plot printer to make it look like you hand drew it.
Yeah, those were more like experiments, but we did it a few times, but yeah.
Yeah, and this was back in Illinois, right?
So yeah, it was back in Illinois.
Yeah, okay, so... You practiced architecture for a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you were, where were you practicing architecture?
I was in Rockford, Illinois.
Okay, Rockford. And what firm were you working at the time?
At the time it was Larson and Darby.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how long were you there for?
Boy, I was there from about 82 to 93. Sorry, 88 to 93. So about 5-6 years.
5-6 years. And did you continue in architecture from there?
Well, what happened is I started getting more and more interested in the, you know, computer aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really enthralled with it, and I started writing about it, which led to magazine articles.
Okay.
Right, like, so, and...
Before blogging.
Yeah, way before blogging, right. Mm-hmm. It was before the internet. Public internet.
Mm-hmm.
And the And that led to a couple of us in town were really into it, and we were like, how can we promote ourselves? So right. we were thinking that we could do this through writing, and that we started pitching book ideas. And we sent one to new writers, and that led to a book for the real interesting software that we had really glommed onto at that time, which was 3D Studio. So that led to writing the book Inside 3D Studio.
Inside 3D Studio. Okay, so we're talking about like 3D Studio 1.
It was 3D Studio. Actually, at that time, 3D Studio 2 had just finished, and we were on the beta for 3D Studio 3.
Okay. I think that's what I learned on, because it was about 93, I'm thinking it's about
the time. Yeah, 92, 93, that was about that time, right.
So, and this is in DOS, right?
All in DOS, right.
Okay, so let's talk about those 3D Studio days, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people who use Macs and you use all of those products that you and I are very familiar with, but this was a product that was not an Autodesk product, right?
It was an Autodesk product, but they didn't make it. So Autodesk published it.
Published it, but
right.
But
it was made by the Yost Group.
By the Yost Group. Let's talk a little bit about the Yost Group, because I think people need to have an interesting, like the foundation of 3D, you know, 3D Studio. And so talk about the Yost Group. Where did that come from?
So the Yost Group actually so the ringleader there was Gary Yost.
Gary Yost.
And, and he wasn't really the programmer. He was more of the combination development manager, product manager.
Okay.
As well as like social manager.
Okay.
He really built the community and learned from them what to do.
Right.
And he actually came from the Atari world.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, he had built products on the Atari.
Okay.
And I might get these names wrong, but things like CyberCAD or Cyber 3D were some of his. And it was him and one programmer named Tom Hudson that had done all that work. And they came to Autodesk and basically pitched two ideas. They said, we should do a 3D tool and a paint tool.
Okay.
And the paint tool became Animator. And
right.
And the other tool became 3D Studio.
An Animator was almost like a onion skin animation tool that they did, right?
Yeah, it was totally. I mean, it was all 8-bit color.
Right.
Way back then, when you had palettes.
Right.
You went through a palette of 256, and you were working with. And then it was all animation.
Not 8-bit per channel, but literally 8-bit.
Literally 8-bit for everything.
Right.
So you had 256 colors. Pick from the 16 million that you like.
Right. Yeah.
And then it was totally an animation tool, but it was very flipbook. It started out at 320 by CGA resolution. Mm-hmm. And then the pro version came out and it could do up to like 1024.
Oh, really? I didn't know it got that high.
Oh, yeah. It actually.
Oh, 1024 by 768.
Exactly. Right. So that was kind of like the parallel product to a 3D Studio, because they needed a paint program.
Right.
Because Photoshop at that time was kind of like nascent. There was actually another product at the time competing with Photoshop called PhotoStyler, and they were kind of like beating it out. And Windows was barely there at all, and they needed something on DOS.
There was no Windows.
Windows was
I remember. It was not even 3.1.
It wasn't. It was before that.
Right.
It was
Windows 1.0, and it was terrible.
It was very bad.
Right.
And so they needed a DOS solution for paint.
And I remember, so they
delivered it.
Right. And so, interesting. Because I remember one of the first versions of the public Photoshop before, and that was not that. That was around not all that time.
It was, it was
like a couple of years in between all that stuff. So you had Photoshop, 3D Studio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing that was interesting about those products, to me, as someone, imagine me in architecture school in 93, right? And they set us up at Rice Architecture School in a big new lab they called Ravel. It was called the Rice Advanced Visual Lab, right?
Uh-huh.
And they had convinced Rice to buy all these O2s and to put Wavefront on him and Alias and all that stuff. And they're like, we're going to use the same tools they did Jurassic Park in, blah, 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 blah. Well, it was really hard to figure out how to get architecture stuff done on Wavefront.
Of course.
Of course, as you can imagine, right? Yeah. So I learned because I was like, because I was one of those obsessive guys who wanted to learn it. And I was like, and I knew more about it than anyone else in the school. And I still said, this is a very disturbing and hard experience to get architecture done in Wavefront. But then there was 3D Studio, right, in mm-hmm. DOS. And the biggest thing that was there, it was that I could actually get models from AutoCAD into 3D Studio.
Through DXF.
Through a DXF format, yes. Through a DXF format. And I could actually work in that area, uh-huh. in that way. And actually, I was still modeling in AutoCAD at that mm-hmm. point mm-hmm. and getting it into 3D Studio. But it was on a 46DX2. That was what I was using back then. Mm-hmm. So those were the PCs they had at that time.
Oh, yeah. At that time, like...
Just before Pentiums.
Well, yeah. Way back then, the 4666
yeah.
was like king of the road. Kicking the road for like 3 years.
Yeah, it was.
Because the Pentium took so long to come out.
Right. Yeah. And so the Pentium, you'll appreciate this. I convinced my parents that because I was doing so much CG stuff, just like, I need a computer for school. And I wanted the very first Pentium was a Pentium 90. And I got it. But it was so new that it had the chip error in it. Do you remember the very first Pentium had a math problem in it?
Oh, really? Okay.
Where the floating point was incorrect.
Oh, okay.
And there was a recall on it. So I actually got them to replace my Pentium chip for a new Pentium chip. But yeah, it was a very interesting little thing. But but at that time, Photoshop was coming out, and that mm-hmm. was on the Mac. So I was bouncing around from the SGI to the PC to do 3D Studio mm-hmm. to the Mac to do Photoshop, and it was different whatever they were doing, but they were all happening at the same time. It was mm-hmm. this kind of a wonderful moment in creating CG.
Right. And at the same time, there was also the Amiga.
And the Amiga. Right. And that was not part of the Amiga movie.
Yeah, I mean, with Lightwave and everything
right,
else.
Yeah, right. I was not, I didn't know about
the toaster.
The yeah. video toaster and mm-hmm. all that stuff. I had no concept of that because at Rice, Amiga was not even part of the picture.
Of course, but...
Right. Yeah. But it was a very interesting time. So that was kind of a revolutionary moment in this time. Like Gary Yost doing that stuff, and they're all kind of these rebel guys, right?
Oh, it was the Wild West.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So what got you transitioning from, you know, being a guy that wanted to write articles out there to being a guy who's actually working in doing that software?
Yeah, so
stuff.
I actually got just very lucky. So the book...
You wrote a book?
Yeah, we wrote the book. 3D Studio was over 1,000 pages.
Wow.
Yeah, and it hit a chord because it wasn't a typical pirate book. You remember back then, there was the software, but then there was the manuals because nothing was online.
Right.
So it was like... The manuals almost became the dongle.
Right.
And so what became popular at that way back then were like pirate books, which basically replaced the manual.
Right.
And ours was not that. We didn't regurgitate the manual. We actually went and investigated the product and like taught you the product in like classic CG ways. How would you use it? How would you apply it? And it became, you know, more of a textbook than it did a manual.
Right.
Anyways, Autodesk read it. It also was like, it was selling really well. And they basically called me up and said, do you want a job?
That's not lucky. That's because they read the book and they said, do you want a job, right?
Yeah. So I was like, I can take a vacation from architecture for a while. And this lasted a few decades.
Right. Yeah. So what was your job at Autodesk?
I came in at Autodesk as actually heading up their training group, which actually trained the resellers.
Okay.
In like how to use the software, but at the same time, I was kind of like Gary's inside man. So the Yost group was entirely outside of Autodesk. So outside that nobody at Autodesk ever talked to them.
Okay.
And back then, the forum situation was all in something called CompuServe.
Yes.
Way back before internet
forums.
That's
where V-Ray started.
Okay.
No, actually, on the Delphi forums.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was CompuServe before, yeah, you know, before internet,
mm-hmm,
and it was very live social community.
Right.
And that's where they did all the support. And that's actually what Gary and his partner Jack, by partner I mean business partner,
mm-hmm,
Jack Powell, invested in the most. It was like, we're going to just like answer every single question that comes up, and you know, really build a community. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so they built this real social community, and that's what we glommed onto for actually testing all the theories of our book.
Right.
When we were like writing it and everything else, and we started becoming part of that little community.
Interesting.
And so when I came into Autodesk, I was like one of the family, and so to speak, of like, I was like one of the people that he felt was like part of his community.
Right.
And because of that, I was able to be part of the inside group that then defined the next version, not just 3D Studio 4, but also 3D Studio Max.
Right. So let's talk about that transition.
Uh-huh.
Going from 3D Studio to 3D Studio Max.
Uh-huh.
That must have been huge.
It was ground shattering, because
I remember as a user going to that, it's like, this is completely different.
Well, not only that, but if you think back on what those programmers did, they did an enormous transition. So now the original 3D Studio was really only done by two programmers. It was done by Tom Hudson and Dan Silva.
Okay.
And they basically doubled the team to four to do 3D Studio Max. And they had a couple other programmers as well help out in addition. And so coming from Wavefront was Don Britton, for example,
yeah,
who had done a lot on the Advanced Visualizer and everything else, mm-hmm, and so he was like the man behind the whole graphics infrastructure.
So he came from Wavefront,
yeah,
and then went to 3D Studio to help with Max.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. Hmm? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. He did. He joined the Yoast group as a full member to help them out.
Nice. Interesting.
The most interesting thing is that this was back in, you know, the 90s, the mm-hmm entire team was distributed. So we had like, you know, we had six people in five states.
Okay.
And just at that time, ISDN had come in and that gave fast enough bandwidth so that the guys could actually check in builds and get them made quick enough. Because before that, it just was too slow.
Well, yeah, it was 56K, right?
Yeah, right. So, you know, ISDN saved the day,
right,
and allowed that distributed group to actually, you know, build the product.
So you guys made a remote
system. Oh, that was entirely... you know, Gary really taught me about distributed development.
Okay.
Way back then, and I've actually applied it in every situation since, in like how to manage and work with remote people. It was actually one of the most valuable things I learned.
And that was a long time ago. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very valuable information, because that's something that a lot of people are struggling with today, even on the creative side, that everything is, you know, face-to-face always helps, but there's... Sometimes you don't have that luxury, and if you want to get talent, you're going to have to possibly deal with remote situations, right?
Oh, yeah. And in fact, the theory was, I mean, you know, go forward now 7 or 8 years, and we were having to build up at that time what was called Kinetics to actually build a whole to compete, you know, in the multimedia area. And we had to hire in the middle of the dot-com craziness.
Yes.
And our secret weapon was we could hire the best and let them live where they wanted.
Right.
So that's what we did. We hired people from, I mean, in Minneapolis and Seattle, in far-flung regions, and we didn't make a move to the Bay Area. We just let them be where they were comfortable, and we were able to get really good talent.
So... this was still under Yoast Group, and then turned into Kinetics? How did that happen?
Yeah, so I was kind of like the go-between the Yoast Group and Autodesk.
Okay. Because Autodesk still was distributing the software.
Yeah, Autodesk Autodesk was the publisher. So it was kind of like a book deal where you have a publisher and an author.
Okay.
An author writes the book, the publisher puts a cover on it and distributes it, and the author come to a few book signings. That's kind of the relationship it was with the US Group.
Right.
They've got a set royalty based upon sales, just as an author would in selling a book.
Right.
So that was the relationship. And back in the 3D Studio DOS days, the actual development contribution from Autodesk was the installer.
Okay.
That's it.
Got it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. And one other important part, the FarLap memory expander, which allowed them to go beyond 64K.
Right.
So that was actually, that. Without that, 3D Studio would have been a much different product. And because Autodesk had a license for it, that actually contributed to 3D Studio, and it could use as much RAM as you put in the machine.
Right.
But that was actually cutting edge back then.
Yeah, because of the DOS limitation, right?
So then what happened with 3D Studio Max is that they created this amazing version, next-gen product, right? Mm-hmm. That was, and they really kind of wanted to pass the baton.
Sure.
And Autodesk, over time, meaning about a year or so, agreed to that. And over the version 2 cycle, we started the transition. And we started a two-version transition, whereas the OS group would basically teach Autodesk how to make 3D Studio Max.
Right.
And Autodesk got to hire people that actually knew anything about animation.
Okay.
And so I was actually part of that team that then built that team.
That built the team that could do animation
inside
of
exactly.
it. Right, exactly. Interesting. So the whole, what was Biped and all that weird stuff that was...
Biped? Which was Character Studio.
Right.
Right. And that was actually another published product.
Interesting.
So that was with another team, a very talented team that we actually... It was actually super wise. What they did is that they said, okay, this entire concept of this product, 3D Studio Max, which was codenamed Jaguar, mm-hmm. the whole idea behind that was plugins. And so everything was going to be plugin-based. Everything was going to be extensible. Everything was extensible. You think you got it with AutoCAD? You haven't seen anything yet. We're going to do it all with Max.
Right.
And they wanted... One of the most challenging things they could do, they wanted something to really test the extensibility.
To show people that you can do it as a plugin.
Right. So while it was in pre-alpha, while it was basically just in just barely working builds, they worked with that team and to basically prove the API of building a complete animation plugin.
Right.
And that's what Character Studio, which was a combination of two plugins, Biped and Physique, was.
Right. Yeah.
But what it really was doing was proving the API.
Proving that the API could work. So it was basically this, like, we've got the best plugin platform possible, and we've made a plugin to prove to you that we can do it.
Pretty much.
Right. And so this was still under Kinetics, right?
Yeah, so Kinetics, remember, Kinetics was a division of Autodesk.
Okay.
So it started out as the multimedia division.
Yes.
And the problem at that point was we just got slandered as being, oh, you're from a CAD company. Which was like one of the worst things you could say to somebody who was in multimedia, right?
Right.
You're from a CAD company. And so the general manager at the time was wise enough to realize we got to completely rebrand. The bear hug from Autodesk was just too much. And so he pulled away in branding to completely create a division called Kinetics, and we were so good at it, most people thought we were an independent company.
Yes, you. Yeah, absolutely.
And within a year and a half, we were now being slandered by saying, "Oh, you're just for games."
Wow.
You know what? I'll take that trade anytime.
Sure. Yeah. But somehow you end up becoming a part of Discrete.
That was because, a couple years later, Autodesk purchased Discrete Logic. So Autodesk acquired Discrete Logic. Mm-hmm. And
which made Flame.
Flame, Inferno,
right.
Smoke, all of those.
Yeah.
and they combined the divisions together into one. So the kinetics name was retired, and then so that's how.
But
it
was still technically part of Autodesk.
Oh, of course it was.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it was always part of. I mean, once Richard sold Discrete Logic, it was, right, of course, all part of Autodesk.
Autodesk. Okay, yeah. Interesting.
He was actually the largest stockholder for a while.
Well, interesting. Okay, so that means that 3D Studio kind of never was always kind of part of the Autodesk family for a long time.
Well, it was always part of Autodesk.
Right.
It was only, so the Max version was only completely developed outside of Autodesk for version 1.
Okay.
And then in version 2, it contributed maybe about 20%. And in version 2.5, it contributed about 30%. And by version 3, it contributed about maybe 50 or 60%.
Okay.
And, you know, by version 4, the Yoast group was pretty much only consulting. So that was kind of like the passing of the baton.
So what is, I mean, Yoast group is pretty much disbanded at this point, right?
Yeah, after the acquisition, after they were done with helping us with those versions, they all went their separate ways.
Right. Interesting. But nonetheless, 3D Studio Max, or 3DS Max, as mm-hmm. it's called now, mm-hmm. Is a very powerful product and has lived on in both the architecture world and the game world, right? It's like it still has this...
And visual effects.
And mm-hmm. visual effects. So it still has this, like, we're going to solve a lot of your random common problems. It's always been this product that's been kind of...
Yeah, it's the true 3D Swiss Army knife.
Right, mm-hmm. yeah. But you had moved on at some point and went to Adobe?
It was later. Let me see. I left Autodesk and in 2002.
Okay.
And then I actually went and did a startup with one of the developers of 3D Studio Max, Don Britton.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a startup for a little while.
What was the startup?
And the startup was called Instant Effects. We were actually, we saw all the graphics hardware out there that was being untapped, and mm-hmm. we created technology to go harness it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically turning PowerPoint into a 3D authoring tool where you could turn it into, so it became like a 3D titling and animation product.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. What happened from there?
That product or that technology was at an interesting stage in terms of the hardware adoption.
Sure.
At the time, we were hoping that everything that Microsoft was doing to push their new agenda on graphics would work.
Which was that the DirectX stuff? Or
it was... I'm forgetting the terms right now,
okay.
but it was, they had really pushed hard to make the next version of Windows be really 3D graphics heavy.
Okay, yeah.
And then they backed off on it.
Interesting.
And when they did that, all of the hardware requirements for all the vendors went down.
Right.
And so what we were
what you assumed was going to be the future.
Right. So our target was off. We were
right.
So as a result, we were off by a couple of years.
Okay.
And as it may happen, you know, being in a startup was a little, you know, always has its own, you know, has its own challenges.
Sure.
I had a new child at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking for a little bit more stability, and mm-hmm. I joined Mental Images.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so that obviously, 3D Studio had a relationship with Mental Images, right? That was
In fact, I was the person that signed the contracts to bring Mental Ray into Autodesk.
Right. Okay. So you became part of Mental Images, and what were you going to do at Mental Images at that point?
I helped them with their brand new platform, which was called Reality Server, which mm-hmm. was actually trying to use their rendering technology remotely, client server.
Okay.
Before the term cloud was around.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, it took a lot longer to explain things before you could just say cloud.
Right. cloud makes more sense.
It shortens the conversation amazingly.
Right.
But anyways, it was a brilliant idea that was simply way before its time.
Interesting.
And so that was it was great working with extremely talented and forward-looking people, but it was just a little bit too early.
Interesting. And so what were you doing besides that? I mean, obviously you stayed at Mental Images for how long?
About a year and a half.
And then what happened after that?
So because I'm a product person, mm-hmm. because I really help people, build product.
Right.
I was before the product, which was a little bit odd.
Right.
And
you almost were there too soon.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And I was brought in because they saw me as the CEO, Rolf Herkin, saw me mm-hmm. as somebody that could really help, but I was too early.
Right.
Then the person that I had actually worked with at Kinetics, Jim Girard, mm-hmm. Was at Adobe. And he was previously at Macromedia. They had just gotten acquired.
Uh-huh.
And they go, "We have a lot of stuff to figure out. I think you can help us."
Okay.
And so then I joined Adobe to help in that transition.
So you were helping with the Macromedia Adobe transition?
Correct.
So like Flash and Director and all that stuff?
Yeah. Director had already been kind of like put to the side.
Right,
because
Flash pretty much replaced it at that point.
Yeah, but so the emphasis was really on Flash, Dreamweaver, and Fireworks,
right.
Which became the studio product, which mm-hmm. from Macromedia, and then that became the Creative Suite Web Edition back for CS3.
Yeah.
Which was actually a knockout hit because what we concentrated on that entire year was just cross compatibility between all the Macromedia and all the Adobe products.
Right.
So like getting, Illustrator files into, Illustrator format into Flash and things like that.
Right.
Was just like godsend to people.
Yeah, and that's what people expect out of Creative Cloud now.
Right. But that's what we concentrated on right from the beginning. And
right.
So that's what I helped with there.
Yeah. So that must have been pretty challenging, obviously. And what was it like coming from, coming with this little rebel group out of Autodesk? Obviously, Autodesk was not a small company, but you're still a little bit of a rebel group, uh-huh. kind of working for Adobe. Adobe must have been a pretty big company. I guess maybe it wasn't that big back then. It's nice, huge now, obviously.
Well, it was pretty large, but it was kind of like on the same par as Autodesk.
Okay.
But every one of these, when you talk about these larger companies, every one of them boils down to a product group, and then to a development team and a marketing team,
mm-hmm.
and they're all fairly family size.
So, okay. Yeah.
So it doesn't matter.
So every time you're with a team that's small enough that's doing stuff. Right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I mean, even for example, at that time, even something as big as Photoshop, which was making a great deal of money for Adobe, you're talking about 80 people.
Mm-hmm. Oh shit! Right.
I mean, it's not that huge,
right.
in terms of the people actually producing the product.
Right.
And so you get to know the people that really matter, and that becomes, it's not that different than working at a smaller group like at Kinetics.
Right. Okay. So how long were you over at Adobe for?
I was there for about a year and a half ago.
Oh, okay. So part of that transition. So what happened after Adobe and what got you to move on?
Oh, well, actually, that was actually just a more of a personal thing. I had some family issues that I needed to tend to back home.
Okay.
And so we actually relocated back to Illinois.
Okay.
Where I actually went back into architecture for a while.
Really?
Yeah.
So how many years between coming from architecture, going back to architecture?
Oh boy, there was about, let me see, it's been about 18 years.
So for you left architecture 18 years later. You went back to architecture, and you were practicing?
Yeah, I actually came in and bought in as a principal. I was actually a partner in the firm, and
That's some skills, dude.
the one thing architecture teaches you a lot of schools. One of the things they never teach you, at least I've never heard of it, is marketing.
Oh, right.
They never teach you how to promote yourself.
Right.
And that was one of the things I had actually learned in all my years in building and promoting software.
Sure.
So I just kind of like turned those skills back and tried to help them build their brand and their marketing efforts.
Interesting.
And so while I was there, and then when my family got sorted, then we looked back at what other opportunities there were, and the best opportunity was NVIDIA. So I came back to the Bay Area with NVIDIA.
Okay, so about what year was that? So it's probably
2008 or something.
2008. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So you went back to NVIDIA. So NVIDIA, obviously at that time, hardware company.
Yeah, and ironically, they had just purchased my old company, Mental Images.
Mental Images, right. So is that why they hired you, or is that one of the things?
Well, they knew I could. They knew I knew them, and they knew I could relate to them.
Okay.
So that was one of the. I'm sure that
that was a deciding factor. I'm
sure that influenced things. Yeah.
Right.
But that what they really needed, they were trying to build software solutions that really made their hardware shine. And to get them adopted, they needed to talk to software companies.
Right.
And what they found was they didn't know how to talk to software companies.
Okay.
And that's where I came in.
Because you could talk to software companies?
Right. I could think like a software company.
But you guys ended up actually making software.
Yeah, so that was a transition over time,
okay.
Which was when I came in, we were all building SDKs and ways of accelerating other products, and we were all about enabling.
Okay.
And then at a certain point, it became obvious that you can help people all you want to, but they're going to be much slower unless you show them the way.
Okay.
And so we decided to build our own solutions that could then, you know, kind of like be the canary in the coal mine. It could,
okay.
It could actually find out all the things that needed to get changed early so that it could get fixed, and then also you could be inspiring to people. You could actually show them what was possible.
So the whole idea behind, like, you guys would develop some crazy hardware at NVIDIA.
Yeah.
They still do. But also it was like, yeah, we're going to make a piece of hardware just to make sure that, or a piece of software just to make sure that what we thought was possible actually is possible.
Right, and we'll adapt the software to prove that what we just did actually works.
Right.
And inspire people.
So was that the whole idea behind iRay?
It was one of the major reasons behind iRay.
Okay. And so that was a thing that was very interesting to me, because like iRay obviously was a competing ray tracer, but it seemed like, you know, when I joined Chaos Group, it seemed like there was never much animosity between iRay and V-Ray. In fact, there was a lot of like exchanging of like, well, here's what we figured out.
That's what we tried. We tried to exchange best practices.
Right.
I met Peter and Vlado back way in the day, and they were always a little bit, you know, bit cautious, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Of course, well, competitors, right?
Right, and we wanted to help, you know, Chaos Group. Mm-hmm. It turns out Chaos Group didn't need any help,
right?
And so they were pioneers in their own way, and
right.
you know, God bless them.
Mm-hmm.
What we tried to do was, whenever we did find things out, we would still send them, "Hey, this is what we just found out. You know, this architecture is, is better accessed if you do this approach."
Mm-hmm.
Blah blah blah, and we would always send those notes across.
Right.
And apparently they helped Nam then.
That was really cool. I remember very specifically, I was at some SIGGRAPH, and it was just you, like, going up to Vlado and just chatting with him. And it's like, I just found it very funny. It's like, but they make Irene. Here's Phil Miller. He's, like, one of the head guys of Irene, and he's talking to Vlado, and he's, like, banging around. Like, I was like, this is a very different relationship. So NVIDIA basically, you know, invested into this area. At that time, they obviously owned Mental Ray mm-hmm. and Iray, and they were doing stuff. And mm-hmm. I guess the ray tracing was an important part of NVIDIA's DNA for a long time.
Yeah.
Right? So ray tracing was part of it, even though CUDA can only go so far. CUDA goes very far in terms of ray tracing, but like the idea of ray tracing in NVIDIA, they've been thinking about this for 20 years more.
What got their attention was actually about 10 or 11 years ago mm-hmm. when Intel really started to get aggressive with Larrabee.
Okay, what's that?
Larrabee?
Yeah, explain.
So
you have to explain it.
So Larrabee was their next generation, 64-bit processor, blah, mm-hmm. blah, 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 that, and now it's called Mike or something like that. It's changed names a couple times.
Okay.
But back then it was Larrabee. And at that time, if you go back and look at all the old press releases and chest thumping,
right?
Intel said that the future of games is ray tracing, and you can't ray trace on a GPU.
Okay, so what year? Year wise,
that was the year before they acquired Mental Images. Okay. So that was being like 2006, 2007. Okay. Yeah.
So ray tracing. So that just the idea of saying ray tracing was the future, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, through the gauntlet.
So we're looking at like early 2000s at this point.
Well, mid-2000s, right.
Mid-2000s,
right. And basically Intel threw the gauntlet down, mm-hmm. and NVIDIA picked it up.
Right.
And said, oh, yeah? And so they did their damnedest to prove... First of all, they had to prove that ray tracing could actually happen on a GPU.
Right.
There's many reasons why people thought it could not happen. And they proved it could happen, and then they had to show how you could actually develop on it and build other ray tracers.
Okay, let's talk about Gelato for a second.
Gelato, okay.
So how did that fit into that area?
That was actually earlier to the gauntlet being thrown down.
Yes.
So that was actually them just thinking that they wanted to get closer into visual effects and the whole area.
Uh-huh.
And that it would be great if they had a GPU acceleration story.
So Gelato was developed. Yeah, if you realize, like some people may not know, so this whole story. So Gelato was developed in Australia, right?
Or? No. It was a company in the Bay Area.
Bay Area, okay.
Right. Out of Berkeley.
Okay. Yeah.
And they acquired them, and so they actually had a renderer at the time. And then they were going to bring it over into NVIDIA and get some GPU acceleration into it.
Right. But so GPU acceleration was, that concept was happening early, like mid-2000s, as you said, right?
It was. But this was when CUDA was still Brook. It was not even a formal programming language yet.
Right.
It was a research study coming out of Palo Alto.
Okay.
And it was, so you had to do it with GPU programming out of GLSL.
Yes.
So it was not optimal at all. They barely got it to work.
Because I know that the earliest versions of V-Ray GPU were before CUDA.
Or right when it became available.
Right.
It was right on the edge.
They actually tried to shove a shader inside of something
Oh yeah, and in fact, it was actually really funny. So at that SIGGRAPH, which was in New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
NVIDIA showed two things. They showed the very first version of OPTICS and their OPTICS samples, mm-hmm. and the OPTICS is a ray tracing engine to help you and it was based on CUDA and everything else. Mm-hmm. And it had not shipped yet. It was like the debut. At the same time, they showed iRay, the mm-hmm. very, very first before it ever was included in the product. Mm-hmm. And then, without NVIDIA knowing anything, Chaos Group shows V-Ray RT at their user group.
Right. And I was there.
NVIDIA is entirely flat-footed. They have no idea what's going on.
Right. And it was not even CUDA-based. Right.
They had no idea what was going on.
Right. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was out there at the debut of it. It was actually in a hotel in Santa Monica.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah.
It wasn't even in New Orleans, huh?
No. Well, yeah, they were. Yeah, it was amazing. And they were like, yeah, we're going to go there. And they were like showing us like, what did I just see? Because that was amazing.
Yeah, it was a big WTF moment. For there.
And the thing I think that's important to people to realize is that when everyone's talking about GPU rendering, V-Ray was there at the earliest days of GPU rendering.
Yeah, because CUDA at that point could barely do it at all. And right. It could only be done by experts within NVIDIA.
Right.
Anyone else trying it were not going to succeed.
Right.
And somehow Chaos Group managed to do it. And that was pretty amazing. So that while it's not a bright spot on the CG roadmap, that point was actually pretty interesting.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, we stuck with it and stuff. And the thing is, we've been doing this GPU stuff for a long time. We've been trying to figure it out. I remember following it, and it was still in the days when you could get like 1 gig of memory on a video card, right? Or 2 gigs possibly.
Oh, 1 gig was actually brand new. Yeah.
Right. You know, it was like really, really.
Oh, no, I forget. When I joined, they had just barely gotten 4 gigs to work. It was they actually had branded the I can't remember what it was called, the Quadro 6000 or something mm-hmm. like that.
Okay.
And it had 4 gigs, which was amazing because it blew past the Windows memory limit.
Which was 2 gigs.
Yeah, and they had to do all sorts of gymnastics to make that work.
Probably cost a fortune.
But it had just happened that they had achieved 4 gigabytes.
Right.
But that was like with a $5,000 card.
Yeah, right. Right. So, obviously, you know, you were part of the NVIDIA team. You spent a lot of time there. You were not only part of it, you were a great advisor for us in terms of helping us on stuff. And now you've been part of the Chaos Group team, which has been awesome. And honestly speaking, Phil, since you've joined Chaos Group, which is, you know, like we said, just over a year ago, it has been amazing to tap into you as a resource of going to people and say, is this the right way to go? Because you have a history to know, like, based on my historic knowledge, that's going to work or that's not going to work. Because I think a lot of people don't have that knowledge. You know, knowing the amount of stuff that you do is actually kind of amazing and being really important to moving a product forward and doing those decisions. And even just your knowledge of, like, here's what we got to do to make this product work and here's what we got to do to do this stuff. But that's from the business side of things, which, and the day-to-day operation stuff, which most of my listeners are not necessarily going to want to, but I really want to thank you for being part of that because it's really helped me a lot understand certain perspectives on things. But I do think that what the listeners would be interested in hearing is you obviously have a huge amount of knowledge in terms of just not just the 3D group and the rendering and ray tracing and all that stuff, especially ray tracing. What are some of the things that people are going to be able to see in the future in terms of ray tracing and in terms of rendering in general? Like what's going to become something in that area that you think is going to be surprising people?
Oh, well, you know, we ask ourselves that all the time because we always have to plan ahead, right? So rendering is always going to get quicker. The question is whether it matters.
Okay.
Right? I mean, I mean, I had one, studio person tell me a while ago that, he goes, I got three speeds. It's overnight, it's a coffee break, or, it's real time.
Right.
Until you make a stepwise change into one of those two, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So, making it 50% faster is appreciated, but it's not game changing.
Right.
So we need to look for things that are game changing in terms of speed.
You need
If,
60 times faster.
yeah, or, at least, so you stop from having to take a coffee break to making it totally interactive or, totally fluid or whatever else. When that happens, many things can happen, right?
Okay.
So the new, ray tracing hardware from NVIDIA is very interesting
Okay.
because, for example, with our project Lavina, we are able to get, about 5 times faster than without it.
Right.
And so that is getting close to making a dramatic change.
Right.
But it's not just about speed, it's about workflow. Because
Okay.
people don't, speed in itself, like I said, it's appreciated, but you need to be looking at the overall. What are you trying to achieve?
Okay.
And that's where, I'm trying to challenge, my entire team within Chaos Group to really look at how can we make the world better for people? What are the problems they're really trying to solve? Rendering is just part of it.
Okay.
It's too easy to say, I need that rendering thing. What are you really trying to do? I'm really trying to visualize the light. I'm really trying to pick a paint color. I'm really trying to feel what the space is like. So we want to take a look at those overall needs and solve them. And that's what I think we can do going forward. So, and speed might be part of that, but workflow is even more part of that.
Interesting.
And so that's what we're concentrating on.
So you think workflow is going to become the important challenge of rendering more than anything else?
I do because back in the day, we knew what to do. If we go back 10, 20 years, we would just hold up a photograph and go, achieve that look.
Right. Okay.
And we'd come up with different techniques and tricks and everything else to achieve that look, whether it be caustics or diffuse reflection or whatever you have. And sometimes there were cheats. Finally, it became physically based. But in a general, you were trying to achieve what a photo did.
Right.
We've been there for a while.
Yeah, so we've solved
So,
all those problems.
exactly. We can achieve what we can do in a photograph.
Right.
Now the question is, how do I get there quicker? And even, do I want it to be a photograph? Do
Right.
I want it to be something else? Do I want it to be
Right.
an artistic expression? So achieving the result is now the challenge of really helping artists, see their vision. For
Right.
example, it's super easy to make something look super clean.
Yeah.
What's hard is randomness. What's hard is making it look dirty and cruddy and like it's aged and everything else.
Sure.
And that in itself is a project.
Right.
And that, while it's not rendering per se, it can be
Yep.
part of the process.
It's true.
So I don't see our mission as being creating pretty pictures. I see ourselves as help
Creating
ourselves.
pretty pictures in an intuitive way.
I see us like realizing your dreams. What do
Right.
you want that to be?
Right.
And, maybe the creation tool isn't doing it. Maybe we have to enhance it. Maybe we have to do all sorts of things to allow you to get to your vision.
Right.
And that is what it's all about. And more processing speed, more capabilities, the tools getting better, that all helps. But a lot of that is just are just building blocks.
Yeah.
And we're the end game of it all.
Right.
Because we're the ones that produce the final image. So we're the ones that can collect and
Not only
produce
produce the final image, we produce the final image based on real physics.
real physics, or maybe, and in the future, maybe it's on you know, styles or desires or anything else.
Right.
The power
or bent
of AI.
Physics.
Yeah. Well, yeah. AI and deep learning opened up a whole new opportunities.
Right. Yeah. It's a great way to look at things. I just think that even going back to, you know, some of the beginning of our conversation of like, you know, so. Mm-hmm. What you're doing at Chaos Group and those things, but where do you see all of the stuff that you have applied through all this amazing knowledge and experience that you've had in your past? How do you see that helping Chaos Group and helping our users in that way?
So the great thing about Chaos Group is that it has really deep investments in a lot of different areas.
Okay.
Whether that be rendering, application integrations, cloud leveraging, or even things like physical simulations like with Phoenix, scanning with
Aerospace. I want to go back to that just for a second because I think people might have missed that. People think of Chaos Group as a rendering company, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's only one thing we do.
Exactly.
We actually are really good at integrating a product, it could be rendering, but it could be anything,
mm-hmm.
into many other products.
Right.
Right? So we have a skill that other people don't have because we actually know how to put something into something else and make that workflow part of a completely unique and different workflow.
Right.
V-Ray for Moto users don't understand how the Houdini user works, right?
Yep.
As an example.
Yep.
But we make a V-Ray for both of those products, and we understand how to integrate our product into that. And that's actually a skill that's beyond ray tracing and beyond rendering.
Right. That's why I separated integration as a skill.
And I want to make sure that people understood what you meant by that, because I wanted to elaborate on that. And then you brought up a couple of other ones. What was the other one you brought up? Cloud?
Yeah.
Cloud is kind of interesting. What do you think about our cloud stuff? Like, in just a higher level, just to explain to why it's a little bit different. It's not just rendering on a cloud.
No, it's not. So working in the cloud is, it's almost like a magic trick. You can leverage all this compute resources if you can do it right.
Right.
And doing it right is hard.
Okay, yeah.
Going and accessing a server and bringing something back, that's easy. Doing it across scale and across millions of frames or thousands of users is really hard.
Right.
And that's what Chaos is really, you know, building and showing that they're good at.
Right.
And that opens up whole new possibilities, because if you now have the power of a supercomputer or, you know, a major studio render farm from your laptop, mm-hmm. that opens up whole new possibilities.
Better. I actually think that our cloud infrastructure, because of like actual the physical infrastructure of the cloud, which is something we never actually physically seen, which is amazing if you think about it that way, is better than most visual effects studios. Try to think of the best render farm of a visual effects studio. You call it Pixar, ILM, whatever. Whatever we're doing on the cloud, whoever's building that, which is GCP at this point, which we can talk about that, that's going to be a better physical infrastructure than anything we've ever where they can ever can be made in those studios.
It would be really hard for anyone to duplicate that.
Especially on a network side.
Oh my God. The transfer speeds are ridiculously fast and reliable.
Right. 60-bit interoperability between servers. Gigabit,
sorry. Yeah, I was going to say.
60 gigabits.
Yeah. The numbers don't look real, but right. the tests come back and it's almost like it's on the LAN.
Right.
It's faster
than the LAN.
Yeah, and it is from Europe to Iowa. And it is...
Wow.
It is amazingly good.
Right.
And secure. And scalable.
Right.
And the processing power that they have on those machines are far beyond what is feasible, or I should say practical, to have, you know, in your own facility.
Right.
Especially on the GPU side. I mean, to have something like 8 V100s on a single node is amazingly overpowered.
Right.
You know, that would, I mean, that is literally like a $60,000 machine.
Right.
That suddenly is just yours for a couple dollars.
Right. Yeah. Which is a really cool thing. And because the fact is, sometimes you buy those $60,000 computers or whatever because you feel you need that power. Most of the time, it's just sitting there collecting dust until you actually use it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when you rent it by the time, only for the time you use it.
Well, and even more so, you know, next year they come out with something else. And
then you can just don't worry about it.
Yeah. And right. Then, but your rental cost is probably about the same.
About the same, or sometimes lower.
Yeah, exactly. And so that gets very exciting. And then the economics of the cloud also get really interesting because it doesn't cost, you know, to go 10 times faster, does, you know, literally only cost 10% more. It doesn't cost 10 times more.
Right.
So these bizarre economics of the cloud is what I call, you know, the magic trick.
Right.
And that's what can really change things for people.
Yeah. So that's part of what you were talking about making people's lives faster and easier and simpler, right?
And changing workflows. So suddenly if you take all the computation power away and make it like on demand from anywhere, from any device, mm-hmm. and you provide an easy interface to it, well, now your customer can use it.
Right.
You can start sharing data, sharing designs, sharing ideas with anybody, not just another expert Maya user,
right,
or Max user. You could actually do it to your producer. You could share it with your actual client.
Sure.
It doesn't matter that they're on a Chromebook.
Right.
They can get a totally interactive experience.
Yeah, I love it. And actually, I did a podcast with the Google guys who actually created an entire virtual studio in completely all, you know, Teradici based on the cloud. So they were doing everything on their Chromebooks.
Uh-huh.
And while that seems like, yeah, that's just a party trick, there was some guys like, I only want to work this way.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I only want to work where all the data and everything I'm doing is there, and the only thing that my computer is doing is a video output to everything that's virtualized.
Right.
So that's a really interesting idea. Okay, so we're actually just over an hour, which is great. You've answered several of my questions. I know I have a lot more. But I actually want to make sure that people who are listening to this podcast, if they have any questions or whatever, they want to ask you stuff, like put it in the comments section. And Phil works for Chaos Group, so he will answer these questions for you if you guys want. But it's been awesome having you, and it's been awesome hanging out in Bulgaria. Luckily, it's not in the dead of winter yet, although it's gotten a little bit colder. but it's nice being back in Bulgaria and hanging out with the guys in Sofia and planning for 2019. Are you excited for 2019?
It's going to be a fantastic year.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's at the end of today, after talking to Peter and Vlado and Boris and you and stuff and Vlon, I was like, oh wow, this is far from business as usual.
Well, what excites me the most about being with Chaos Group is that it reminds me of the old days. It reminds me of building the original 3D Studio Max.
Really?
Oh yeah, because anything's possible.
Yeah.
And the teams are always incredibly excited and forward-looking, and you know, they don't see barriers. They just, you know, are excited.
Yeah.
And it's great to work with a team like that, and you're going to see great things from it.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I agree 100%. All right. Well, thanks, Phil. Thanks so much for doing this. You know, if ever you have something to say or you're coming by and you're like, oh, Chris, we got to do a podcast about this. Let's do it. Let's do it again. Obviously, okay. You're up in the Bay Area and we're down in L.A., but you come to, you know, Sofia. It's funny. I've probably seen you in Sofia more times than I've seen you in L.A. But let's get back together and we'll do another podcast. That would be really cool to do that.
Anytime.
All right. Thanks, Bill.